Welcome to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. For Orion Samuelson, I'm Steve Alexander, and about a week we had on Wall Street with the S&P 500 notching a ninth straight day of losses. That's the longest losing streak for the benchmark index in more than 35 years. On Friday, the S&P lost about 3.5 points at 2085, and the NASDAQ dropped 12 points at 5,046, and the Dow was down about 42 points, or about a quarter of a percent at 17,889. For the week, the Dow was down 1.5%, the S&P lost 1.9%, and the NASDAQ fell 2.8%. Let's begin by talking to Bob Iacino of Path Trading Partners here in Chicago. Bob, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
We had quite a week, right?
Yeah, we really did. Quite a bit of movement, quite a bit of overall negative tone, I'd say.
Yeah, Bob is—you may recognize his voice, and if you saw his face, you'd certainly recognize that as well. He has appeared on all of the cable news network, money channels, financial news networks, and all that kind of thing, and is a well-respected observer of what's going on in the markets. Before we get to the real important stuff, let's begin with the Chicago Cubs winning the World Series. Bob, what kind of impact should that should we see from that on the markets?
The stock market was up double digits in 1908, and the one thing I'll take from that, and of course both of these comments are tongue-in-cheek, gold was at $20.67 in 1908. So if you buy gold every time the Cubs win the World Series and wait 108 years, you got a good shot of being up about 6,000%.
Okay. Well, I like that. I'll buy some right now and hope for the
you should
hope for the best.
Well, both your grandkids and my grandkids will enjoy the 6,000% you may not.
Right. Well, let's switch to the non tongue in cheek type of business and talk about what happened on Wall Street this week. The S&P 500. Yeah, actually, for a while today, I thought we were going to break out of it. Right up until probably the last half hour of trading or so, the markets, especially the S&P, were still in positive territory, and then right at the end, it dipped, and the S&P is longest losing streak in 35 years.
Yeah, that surprised me, to be honest. I mean, when I saw that we hadn't had an 8-day in a row losing streak like we've had, I was surprised by that because the market has had some, over the last 9 years or so, some pretty negative weeks and some pretty negative 2-week periods where you'd think we would have gotten at least 7 or 8 down days in a row, but I went back. I mean, I didn't trust when I heard it. And I went back, and I couldn't find anything. And, you know, there's a lot of takeaway from that. We've got a non-farms payrolls number today, which is always the most important piece of economic data that we get during the week. And it came in sort of a Goldilocks kind of fashion. Weekly hours were up a little bit. Wages were up. I'm sorry, weekly hours were flat. Weekly work hours were flat. Wages were up a little bit. The number came in at a very tame 161 or so, which is not too hot, not too cold, and the unemployment rate dropped. So the interesting part about that, Steve, that I took away, when you see a number like that, you see the equity markets rally, and then you see it fall in toward the end of the day like it did, people were expecting the piling on of institutional money, and that's not what we got. And what you're seeing in toward the end of the day is the long trades that happened after the non-farm number this morning being exited, and possibly even some people who were hoping they were going to get a bump out of the non-farm payrolls number, also exiting, not wanting to hold on to these things for the weekend with the election coming up.
Let's talk about the election, and why is Wall Street so jittery about the election?
You know, I took a survey this morning. I was one of a number of people asked to take the survey by a news outlet, and they asked me what I thought would happen Wednesday morning if Donald Trump won, and I thought the market would be down somewhere in the 3-5% range. And then they asked me what would happen if Hillary Clinton won, and I said, probably down 1%. I mean, I think when you look at the two options, and then let's be realistic, there are only two options, unfortunately. When you look at the two options, you see more of the same from Hillary Clinton, possibly a little bit more spending, but that really depends on what happens on the congressional side, not on the not in the executive branch. I mean, she could win the presidency, and if Congress stays as it is, she won't be able to get anything more done than President Obama's been able to get done in his last term. So it's more of the same, and that same has been sort of just tepid growth, nothing to get too too excited about, but nothing also to jump out of a window about. And Donald Trump, while there are people that believe that some of his policies would spike economic growth, I have two things to tell those people. Number one, it would not happen the first day, if it happened at all. And number two, nobody likes him either. So I'm not sure that he would get anything done. His own party doesn't really support him. So it's really, we're almost electing a lame duck in a strange way.
I've heard it described of Hillary Clinton as being not friendly to business, but friendly to the markets. Do you agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting take on it. I've heard that as well. I think what that means is that, so markets hate uncertainty. I'm probably the 200th person to say that to you this year. Markets hate uncertainty, and Hillary Clinton is not an uncertain commodity. Donald Trump is. So I think that's where that's coming from. I don't think any right-thinking economist believes that the proposals Hillary Clinton is putting forth is going to double GDP. I don't think anyone has said that. I think they'd be laughed off a year show at least if it was said. But she does not scare the equity markets at all. So it goes back to other factors now. And those other factors have been global central banks, and the global central banks know how to deal with this type of a politician. They don't know how to deal with a wild card like Donald Trump.
We've been hearing that the traders are trying to price in the risk, the political risk. In layman's terms, can you tell me how traders go about doing this? How do they hedge on one way or the other on the outcome of Tuesday's election?
Well, it's an interesting mix of things. Mostly what traders do is they would look at the CBOT Volatility Index, the VIX. If you were to pull up a chart of the VIX, again, we're on radio, but if you were to pull up a chart of the VIX, what you'd see is essentially since February of 2016, sideways movement between about 13 and 17, save for two or three spikes that we see all the way up into the 20s. One of those spikes is right now. Now, that's the way traders tend to hedge it, but what you're going to see over the next few days is when the election happens, and nothing crazy happens immediately following the election, you'll see that VIX come off, and they'll start to actually put on positions to hedge Donald Trump's theoretical volatility if he won in the actual market. But right now, not knowing how their specific mix of portfolios are going to act, they have to do it in the VIX. So that's why we've seen this VIX spike. I mean, in the last 3 days, we're up from about 17 to about 22.5, where we sit right about now. And that's from 13. I mean, we've seen 2, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9 up days in the VIX in a row, coinciding with the 8 down days in the S&P. That is mostly election-based.
Let's talk about some of the other factors. The Fed did nothing in its meeting earlier in the week. The expectation that I've heard, and do you agree with, is that the Fed will increase interest rates in December?
I do. I think that every single Fed meeting in the last 3 years has been the least suspenseful Fed meeting, save for maybe last December's meeting. This particular Fed hike that we should get in December is probably the most telegraphed one in history. The interesting thing about the Fed now is you saw some spiking in the 10-year note. Now, just to give you your listeners a little background on what's happening there, the 10-year note is the part of the curve, 10 years and out, is the part of the interest rate curve that the Fed does not and cannot control. Now, if the market does not believe that there's going to be any inflation, any money expansion, then the 10-year note yield needs to go higher. And if that's what's been happening. But then when you look at it historically, it didn't even reach 197 in yield, which is where it reached last time the Fed raised 25 basis points, which was just about a year ago. The point that I take from there is we got to about 183, 184 in 10-year yield, and then we backed off a little bit to about 180. The market doesn't believe there's going to be any more than the December hike, and that's really what traders and investors need to focus on. The December hike is priced in. It's a done deal. What's going to happen after that? And to get cues, you watch the 10-year note yield. If you see that go above 2%, that to me means the market thinks there's more hikes coming, and right now they don't.
Seems like much ado about nothing, though. All the noise and buzz and jitters and all that about an increase that is so relatively small.
Yeah, I mean, it should not have an effect on day-to-day business. You know, it's interesting. A friend of mine told me when they did it in December, he goes, you know, they're increasing rates by almost 100% by going from a 25 basis point target to a 50 basis point target. And that's true, but that's just, it's insignificant in the grand scheme of finance, that 25 basis points they're going to do. Again, it's a matter of whether they're embarking on a rate hike cycle, which nobody believes they are, and the 10-year note doesn't believe they are. So you're right. It's priced into the market, and if the election goes smoothly, as smoothly as this election can go, you're probably going to see a lot of volatility come out.
Let's talk about the impact that crude oil has had on the markets. Crude was down this week by right around 9%. What impact does that have on what's going on Wall Street?
Well, it kind of fights off what the 10-year note was doing. So the pure definition of inflation is an expansion of the money supply, but nobody uses it that way anymore. The Fed and consumers and politicians all use inflation to reflect rising prices because that's usually what happens when the money supply expands. So taking it at its current definition, if crude oil is falling as rapidly as it is and potentially continues to fall, there's been a lot of news this week in particular that's helped to drive those prices down. And we can go through that if you want. But if crude oil is falling, energy is a very, very large part of the economy, the cost of energy. And crude oil specifically, people think about their cars all the time, but they don't think about blacktop and tar and plastics and all these other alloys that crude is an integral part of, whether it's as an ingredient or as a firing mechanism to create these products. So it's absolutely critical in the economy for price control that crude oil doesn't go crazy. People who were relying on OPEC to push their long positions to profitability, really OPEC is not, you don't want to trade off of OPEC, not in any long-term way, and you've seen that now. Everybody that bought crude oil on September 28th or so, when OPEC announced an agreement to have an agreement, is pretty much underwater now and getting hurt pretty bad on those trades.
So overall, is it as simple as too much oil and not enough demand?
It is, and Shell Oil CFO this week, again, another piece of news that hurt oil, Shell Oil CFO this week said that he can see demand falling off in ahead of supply. In other words, demand reaching its peak and turning and falling before supply does. So oil is one of the, I don't want to say it's one of the easiest things to trade. It's definitely not, but it's one of the easiest markets to understand because every week we get sort of snapshots of supply and demand from the different nations. And if you just kind of do the math, you can kind of see the trend. And right now, demand is flat and supply is increasing again.
Let's talk about earnings. We have seen, mostly positive earnings. Is that fair?
That's very fair. At last check, and I haven't got my numbers for this week yet, but at last check, with over 50% of the S&P reporting, we had about 79% beats on EPS. Which is above the long-term average, and we had about 64% beats on revenue, which is about in line with the long-term average. So both of those are good. But we saw of, I want to say, 50-some-odd companies, we saw about 36 guide lower and about 21 guide higher, which is kind of what the market is looking at. Facebook was a great example. Facebook told the market that they were guiding down on revenue growth. So it's interesting, I always laugh when I see those kind of things because I think, well, they're not even saying that they're not going to have growth. They're just guiding down on revenue growth. In other words, revenue is going to grow slower than it did last quarter. And the stock drops about 6.5%. So the market not only wants to see that you did better, but that you're going to do better. And that's really been the big thing. But at the end of the day, if all else is equal and the election goes well and the Fed continues to leave policy easy, we should get another rally here. Those are a lot of big ifs given the current situation.
The latest projection, and this is not coming from any specific source, but just people on social media guessing at what might happen, is that Trump's going to take the popular vote and Clinton will take the delegate count.
I also believe that.
Do you?
By the way, I also think that's exactly what's going to happen.
And what impact will that have?
Well, nothing, really. I mean, there's no path for Donald Trump to contest that because that's the way. I mean, you remember, obviously you and I both remember back to Bush Gore.
Sure.
Where the question was not whether Gore won the popular vote or whether Bush won the popular vote. I believe after several recounts, Bush ended up with a few hundred more on the popular side. But the country was pretty ready to accept that Al Gore won the popular vote, but George Bush won the Electoral College, and that's what elects our president right now.
Right.
I don't think Donald Trump is going to be able to mount serious challenge to the electoral process. Maybe that challenge needs to be made, but it wouldn't be made and done by him, is my guess.
Bob Iacino of Path Trading Partners, thank you so much. Please tell us about Path Trading Partners and how people can reach you.
Sure, Steve. You could go to pathtradingpartners.com. Path Trading was started a couple of years back by myself and my partner, Mike Arnold, and we essentially are a proprietary trading firm, and we also provide some assistance from an analytics standpoint to some rating agencies and some institutions, and we also provide some trader education internationally. We also have a podcast that's getting pretty popular. It's called The Money Path Podcast, and you can find that on our website, or you can get that at the Google Store or iTunes.
The Money Path Podcast.
That's the one.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
You're listening to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. I'm Steve Alexander in for Orion Samuelson. And let's open up the ag bag, and that's where we find Max Armstrong and his special guest.
In the studio is Jerry Goodell from Price Group. Well, can we expect that October rally to continue on through November?
Well, it's going to be quite interesting. We had an interesting setback the last week or so. I think the November corn production number is going to see some slippage here. After October slips, we tend to have an idea that November slips too. I think it's been 8 out of the last 10 years that it's slipped in that situation. And also the trade tends to kind of overestimate the number. Soybeans, a little different story. That tendency has been, particularly with this positive number we had last month, probably up. So I'm not sure we're in the 53 bushel average yield versus the 51.4, I think it was last month. I'm more in the 52 category. Definitely good yields being heard out there. Sometimes I think we're hearing some of the same ones we heard the time before, but hey, you know, at this point, good crop out there. Good demand, though. Fabulous demand. Again, this week we had over 2.5 million metric tons of beans sold for like the second or third week in a row. And I think that's a positive for us. The big thing is, though, to get a huge kind of positive move to the upside, it's going to be some kind of weather out of South America. And I think with the uncertainties of La Nina on an overall stance, and right now it's not really heavy duty, but I think there is a chance that that is still in the factor. And after last year, any blurb in South America is going to have a lot more impact than it had last year.
Just to come back to yield for just a moment, before we leave that subject, I've talked to a lot of growers who said, man, we've had some very good yields, 60, 70 bushel yields coming out of these fields. Where are the bad beans? Are there any out there?
I think there's some bad beans in these double crop areas that's come through here with the late dryness, and also the southern beans I don't think were as strong. If you look at the latest drought monitor, quite a big spot's developed in that Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, southeast areas, and that. Now, I wouldn't say that's a disaster. That's the problem of that we're not going to see that. But also I think that the 70 bushel beans were a lot stronger early, a lot more low 60s the second time around in that. That's still very strong. We've got a 61 or 62 bushel Illinois yield already in here. So how high is high is sometimes something to think about.
So you're not of the opinion that that corn yield could also go up. And you're reflecting back on what we've done in previous years. That, as they say, past performance is no guarantee of future performance, right?
Right. I understand that. But I'd have to also understand what I've heard. Yes, there's people's had 205 bushel yields in Iowa, they were thinking 230. There's that kind of scenario that's come through. There's strong yields out here, folks. I'm not denying that at all. But I don't sense that we've got some unbelievable state yields out here already. And the southern part of Illinois definitely does not anywhere close to 2014 yields. I think that's going to compensate for the middle part of the state. Iowa, some similar situations there. The one areas that are going to have some positive yields and records is going to be the Dakotas. South and North Dakota and many areas of Minnesota definitely have better than 2015.
But, you know, you make an interesting point. I have heard from a number of corn growers, yeah, you know, we had good corn yields. They were not exceptional corn yields is what they told me.
Exactly. And the key thing here is comparison to the best yield they had. Eastern Corn Belt 2 years ago, Western Corn Belt last year. I think those are the situations where overall, good seal. Does a 170 yield all of a sudden turn us bullish? No, not in a big way. But it also takes the psychology of going back down to $3 and just laying there forever away too.
So just to clarify in our minds, where are you on your corn and bean yields looking ahead to the USDA report Wednesday?
I'm a 170.14, I guess it'd be 2 bushels down, and I'm a 52 up, 6/10 of a bushel going north.
How are we doing on usage? I mean, and you talked about the excellent demand. Are we ahead of USDA's numbers with the demand on beans?
We are on target to meet the USDA's projections on export sales. The corn yield, corn side of things, we're solid. We're right on target. That's the one that's maybe a little dicey, but I think people have forgotten the fact that Brazil is virtually out of the corn business. Ukraine is a minor competition. We're going to have strong exports. Once we get this, we have a real capacity issue right now. We cannot push 100 million beans and 50 million corn and 20 million wheat. We only have about 150 million worth of capacity on a weekly basis.
So is that limiting exports, our ability or inability to move it?
On the corn side, it has, but I think they planned on that. We had a very super September. I think we'll have very strong December and January. This November, late October and November is going to be for beans.
We have grain stored outside. I've heard reports of corn piles. That is not unusual, and some elevators just plan on that, do they not?
They do. They have a kind of permanent temporary storage, as some people have called it. And I think the only areas that probably is going to be a major concern is going to be the Western Plains and the Nebraskas and the Dakotas and those areas where I think that I haven't seen that much east of the Mississippi, partly because we didn't have the crop last year, so we had more commercial storage available. And I've heard some pretty good basis levels popping, starting to pick up for that December period for some places in the east.
And that's what growers are really going to be needing to watch for, right?
Definitely. The basis side of this thing is going to be a feature for them. The bean side, there's been constant kind of movement as the harvest is going on. I think the corn that came in was the corn that was already sold, and there hasn't been a lot of corn sold if they can hold on to it. Now, that doesn't mean that in some cases they can do everything, but in most cases they are trying to hold on or find some place to put it, and that's causing some strength in the east.
Government checks came out a few weeks back. That gave some farmers a little breathing room, didn't it?
It did. It did. It's hard to figure out how many dollars you're supposed to get or how much came through, but it was dollars.
I think most everybody was surprised.
Exactly. Partly because they completely forgot about how the whole thing works, because it is a whole year's price delay before you come out with that number and figure out what the value should be. But in general, you had some pretty good deals the last few years. You've had a pretty good check.
Managed funds. Where are they? What are they doing now? Have they buttoned up a little bit ahead of this election? Is there some nervousness on their part? How would you assess what they've been doing, what they're up to now?
Well, I think to some extent, up until this last few days, there's been somewhat of a relaxing of their short positions and that. They never really were totally short by any means in the beans. It was mostly corn and wheat, and there has been some short covering in those areas. But on this latest setback here, there has been some talk of some further short positions coming back into the market. But in general, the uncertainties of the election has provided some uncertainty and less participation for sure.
What's your gut feeling for the waning weeks of this year if that export demand stays constant? What kind of price activity do you think we could expect?
Well, I think that we're probably going to – we're getting near our bottom side of our range. I think we're going to continue in this 360 top side. Well, in the March, you might see a 370 out there against a 350, maybe a 345. In general, I don't sense that there is a – a huge market going on in the corn right now, but I think that there will be a chance for some optimism as we go along because I think there's less of old crop supplies and also some uncertainties in South America. Right now, we even have some uncertainty of too much wet weather in Argentina that's lessening some of the planting that they were talking about just a month or so ago. They were talking about a 25 to 30% increase, and now they're not so sure about that happening in there. On the soybean side, is there a chance for a 10.50 kind of futures price? I'd say that's really the top side of things. But I think the January is going to still bounce around in here from there. Same issues on the export side of things is going to give us some base and some positives. But we're going to need some kind of spark, which I think is going to be available because the world is a lot more sensitive to what weather's doing in South America this year after what happened to last year's situation.
Jerry Goodell, Price Group.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Let's take a look at commodities, beginning with crude oil. Oil futures on Friday fell by their biggest weekly percentage since January of right around 9%. Signs of tensions resurfaced between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and that threatened to put a lot more oil onto the market, and traders decided it was time to sell. Traders also noted a surge in U.S. crude inventories last week, as well as muted demand. Those continued to weigh on futures, essentially too much oil and not enough demand for it. U.S. West Texas Intermediate Texas T futures were down 59 cents or 1.3% on Friday at $44.07 a barrel, having fallen as low as $43.57 a barrel earlier in the session. For the week, again, it was down about 9%, the biggest decline since mid-January. Brent crude futures were down 74 cents, 1.6%, at $45.61 per barrel, ending the week down more than 8%. Switching to agriculture commodities at the Chicago Board of Trade, soybean, wheat, and corn futures were slightly higher on Friday, boosted by light investment fund buying ahead of next week's presidential election, as well as the USDA's monthly supply and demand numbers, which come out next week. But despite Friday's modest gains, corn and soybean futures were down for the week sharply, while wheat futures rose for the first time in 3 weeks. Soybean futures for January settled a penny and a quarter higher at 9.90 and three quarters a bushel on Friday, rebounding from Wednesday's two-week low. For the week, soy prices were down 2%, the largest weekly decline since August. Corn futures, December corn, settled three quarters of a cent higher at 3.84 and three quarters a bushel, also down about 2% for the week. December wheat finished 2.25 cents higher at 4.14 and a quarter, and for the week, wheat gained 1.4%. Traders were largely squaring their positions ahead of the U.S. election on Tuesday, and that USDA report, which comes out on Wednesday, one analyst observed, the market is going nowhere fast. Recapping Wall Street, for the week, the Dow was down 1.5%, the S&P lost 1.9%, and the NASDAQ fell 2.8%. That does it for The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. For Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong, I'm Steve Alexander.